doesn't look like a Jericho missile.
That's because it's a miniaturized arc reactor. I got a big one powering my factory at home. It should keep the shrapnel out of my heart.
But what could it generate?
If my math is right, and it always is, 3 gigajoules per second.
That could warm your heart for 50 lifetimes.
Yeah. Or something big for 15 minutes.
That's right. In this edition of Sci-Fi Sci-Fact is from Iron Man. We've done Iron Man before, but we haven't done the arc reactor. And there you heard Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr. There you had Iron Man talking about a miniature arc reactor. He was doing a DIY job in a seam. And here to talk about whether such a thing, a tiny reactor, could ever happen, one that could power a sort of suit that allows you to fly, shoot missiles, protect your body like an exoskeleton, whether such a reactor could actually exist in real life, is James Rice. Now, he's a PhD candidate at the Robinson Research Institute, which is part of Victoria University of Wellington, where his thesis surrounds the idea of building a high current flux pump for a fusion reactor, I think. Now, if that's not Iron Man, I don't know what is. And occasionally he works with the Diamond Institute researcher Chris Bumby, and he's helping out the Institute by being our guest on Sci-Fi Sci-Fact. Kia ora, James.
Sure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. Great to have you on. James, this really, your PhD really does sound like you're going to be Iron Man one day. High current flux pump. This is the script, isn't it?
It's something similar to the script. There's elements in there I'm sure we can tease out, sure.
I don't want you to give away all your secrets on the radio, but you know.
Yeah, I suspect that I might not want to say every one of the secrets on radio. But yeah, I'm working with the Robinson Research Institute developing these flux pumps to the level that they could potentially be used to help run these kinds of fusion reactors in a very real sense.
Okay, well, before I tease a few more facts out of you, as much as you're comfortable giving away, James, let's go back to the science fiction. So that was a scene from, we're not entirely sure which Iron Man it is. We were talking off air, Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2. Has it been an Iron Man 3? I don't even know. I think there has been.
Yeah, there was Iron Man 3 as well.
Okay.
Now that I've heard it, that was definitely Iron Man 1.
Okay.
Because I rewatched it as preparation for this.
Ah, good.
I'll explain the setting a little bit in case people haven't seen the movie. Tony Stark is this, you know, incredible rock star physicist, basically an engineer. And he builds this Iron Man suit. And the reason he gets into doing that is that he starts off as a weapons manufacturer. He gets captured by some terrorists and they make him build their weapons for them. And he says, stuff this, I'm not going to do that. So instead he makes this reactor and uses it to power a sort of mechatronic suit that can fight his way out of the cave that they've got him locked up in.
Yes, so he's in that cave.
So it's not Asia,
he's stuck in a cave. He's stuck in a cave.
Indeed.
And this reactor is going to power his escape. So it's kind of the beginning of the Iron Man suit, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the genesis we're seeing here live on screen, which is quite cool. He's got, you know, benchtop solder equipment. He's making little rings out of metal and, you know, he's doing metallurgy right in front of us, and we can kind of very much see what he's doing to make it. And he is talking his way through it, which from my perspective is quite handy. So what is it made of? Well, what he does is he takes apart one of these missiles they're telling him to build. He takes some palladium out of it, which is a reasonably rare metal. It doesn't occur very often on the planet Earth. So he takes this rare metal, he melts it down and forms it into this very tiny ring that we see him make very carefully.
Yeah.
And he says that he's got about 9 grams of palladium. He makes this ring. He surrounds it with some, you know, copper coils, and he connects that up to a car battery. Lo and behold, it starts to make energy itself.
It glows.
Lovely blue Cherenkov radiation there. Whether or not it's putting out the full 3 gigawatts, doesn't he, of energy? Not sure.
What does that mean? 3 gigawatts.
If I put that in sort of layman's terms, that's a few thousand households. Actually, you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, that's a few million households a second. That's
right.
It's a lot of energy.
Okay. But this is the thing, James, and in many of these episodes when we've looked at something from the sci-fi world, one of the things we constantly come up against is, well, maybe it could if you just had sufficient energy. You could do it, but the amount of energy you need to actually make this amazing sci-fi thing happen would require an atomic power station on your back. So here in Iron Man, he's got this energy, and it is the size of it's you could fit into a small suitcase.
And yeah, even smaller than that, it fits on his chest. It's rather incredible.
Yeah, so this is perfect. Yeah. Here we have the Holy Grail, which is the energy source that's really, really powerful, but also really portable. And the thing is, James, is there anything about what he's done with the palladium and the copper coils and the car battery that in any way resembles what we could do in this world?
Yeah, it very much resembles what we expect a fusion reactor will look like in the very near future. He's using magnets, and that's an important factor of any kind of fusion reactor, is that fusion reactions are between light elements, typically gases like hydrogen. And when they get hot and dense enough, there's enough pressure, those nuclei can fuse together. And in doing so, they release quite a bit of power. And this is indeed what happens at the center of the sun, right?
Yeah.
And in order to confine that much pressure, you either need the mass of a star or you need to get quite a bit more creative here on Earth. And one of the creative ways that scientists have figured out long ago, I mean, we're talking sort of 1960s, is to use magnetic fields. Is that when you've got charged particles in a magnetic field, the magnetic field guides the way that they move. And if you generate a magnetic field in this sort of circular donut shape, you can confine them to a very specific location or in a little ring, for example. And that's exactly what pretty much every prominent fusion reactor design aims to do, is use some form of electromagnet in some form of ring shape and use that magnetic field to confine hot, dense plasma that fuses and generates energy.
So has he created the magnet with the palladium? Is that what he's done?
I think it's probably what's causing the reactions, but in a very interesting way. Palladium is quite stable, but it has a few isotopes which are reasonably unstable. These are, you know, slightly different ratios of protons and neutrons in the atom. That's an isotope. And some of them are very stable. That's what we find in nature. Some of them are very unstable. So we either have to make them synthetically or they just don't exist very often, commonly. And I think what he's done, and this is rather tricky, is he's made a nuclear battery. It's not technically a fusion reactor, but it's a nuclear battery. And that's a rather interesting idea on its own.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that with a fusion reactor, as I say, you're fusing hydrogen together, and the products then are just stable. The helium that you generate just sits there, and it's a very much a one-way process. A nuclear battery is interesting because if you have two isotopes where one decays, releases something that can then be captured by another isotope that also then generates energy when it captures that electron, you can set up a sort of circuit of sorts between the two isotopes. I think that's what he's done. Palladium-107 decays via beta radiation, so it releases an electron. That can then be captured by palladium-103, which is probably where I get dubious, but let's say it works. When it gets captured, that also decays and generates energy. And because you've got electrons going from one place to another, you can set up a circuit, just like an ordinary, you know, car battery or
battery in your phone. But it's not electricity we're talking about here. Or is this a form of electricity?
In that case, it would be electricity, yeah.
Would it?
It would, because you've got electrons flowing from one place to another.
Yeah, which is what I thought.
So all you have to do is complete that circuit. Hey, presto, you've got a battery.
But why would this battery power a city rather than just a light bulb?
Well, it's a question of how much energy you've got available and how many electrons you're moving. And I guess in this case, you'd have a lot of energy in those electrons because they're being pinged out by an atomic nucleus because it's unstable. It has too much energy to begin with. And so when it releases this electron, that electron carries some energy away, and that means it's moving rather quickly. When it then gets captured, it's turning a less stable nucleus into a more stable nucleus. And that, again, releases more energy as well. So you'd probably find some of that energy is coming off as electricity you can connect up a circuit to, but some of it's probably going to have to come off as heat as well. And capturing that back may be a very different problem again.
And if you've got an unstable isotope of anything, isn't it going to be releasing dangerous radiation as well?
It is, yeah. And that's kind of the part that makes me dubious is, do you really want that to be sitting right next to your chest? It seems like something, maybe a health and safety problem, but the fact that it generates power is reasonably plausible. I'm also dubious about how easily it could capture that electron and, you know, complete that circuit. That's more of a question on the full nuclear physics side of things and is reasonably complicated.
Getting back to the nuclear fusion, is there any fusion going on with that?
I don't think so in Iron Man 1, but in Iron Man 2, he upgrades it. And I think that's where I could imagine it start to be a fusion reactor, like a traditional fusion reactor. I say traditional, but we haven't really got one yet, have we?
No.
But in Iron Man 2, he upgrades his little reactor for the specific reason that it's poisoning him. The palladium is apparently toxic. And I think
they're accounting for that gamma radiation or whatever it might have been coming out of the battery.
Well, I sure hope so, especially based on how it seems to be eating away at his chest in the movie. Yeah, I think he needs to... He did need to upgrade that.
Okay.
But it's quite interesting what he does to upgrade it, right?
Right.
So what he does is he takes this, he has the idea to create a new element, or I think he gets the idea from his dad, really. And so he makes this little triangle and he aims a particle beam at it, which again is quite difficult to do by hand. I'm not sure exactly how he gets his health and
don't
safety.
Don't we need large hadron colliders and synchrotrons, what are they called, to fire particle beams at things?
Yes, we do. They're
actually the size of a small city, or at the very smallest, a sports field, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They take up a large portion of the Swiss countryside. Yeah.
Okay. But he's managed to miniaturize it down to something that fits on his chest. Okay. We'll allow that. So he's got a particle beam.
So he's got
beam.
This particle accelerator, and he's aiming it at a target. And this target, we don't know what this target is made of, but when he aims this particle beam at it, it starts to glow and it starts to rattle and seems to be not liking what he's doing to it. And eventually it becomes stable. It's fine. And Jarvis comes over and says, congratulations, sir, you've created a new element. So clearly what he's done is he's made this incredibly heavy, very stable element, or maybe semi-stable element, by firing a particle beam at some material that he's already got. Then he just puts it straight into his little chest-mounted reactor, and it starts glowing, and it's like, okay, cool, we've replaced the palladium with this new element. Congratulations, that seems to have solved the problem.
In Arc Reactor Mark II, is it still a battery, or is it some kind of fusion reaction that's going on in this chest now that this new element that he's made makes possible?
Yeah, I think at this stage it's probably fusion, because we see him have to put it in and then surrounding material that's typically stable starts to react. So clearly what he's done is create something that helps that fusion take place. Usually you need a lot of pressure and a lot of temperature to cause these reactions to happen. But there have been some rather interesting forays in the course of fusion history towards things like muon-catalyzed fusion.
Sorry?
Which is a
muon.
I know, right?
How do you spell muon?
Muon-catalyzed. Muon, M-U-O-N.
What's a muon?
A muon is a subatomic particle similar to an electron in that it is negatively charged, but it's rather much heavier than an electron. It's about 200 times heavier, in fact. And what that means is that when it forms atoms, those atoms are about 200 times smaller than you'd expect a normal atom to be. And people back in the 1950s, when fusion was first started to be a thought in people's brains, some people had the idea, well, what if we use these muon atoms, put them together, do they start to fuse? And the answer is yes, they do start to fuse. And they do so just enough that maybe it's a good idea. But the muons themselves are very unstable. They decay into electrons in about 2 microseconds, a millionth of a second. So you have to do the fusion very quickly is the problem.
How do you make them in the first place, the muons?
Well, that's what I think Tony's cracked, is that if he's made this incredibly heavy element, we have no idea what it might do. Maybe it's decaying and releasing a lot of these muons while it's sitting there in this ring. And typically they just, you know, decay away into normal electrons, and maybe that generates power on its own. But possibly there's enough of these muons being emitted that the surrounding hydrogen that he's got in his little fusion reactor there can capture those, grab those muons, form very small atoms and molecules of hydrogen that then spontaneously fuse, meaning you don't need the magnets that you see in Iron Man 1, so they're no longer present, makes it a little bit more compact, and I imagine it would probably generate a bit more power that way, as long as you've got a steady source of muons to keep the reaction going. So I think that might be one possible idea that he's managed to crack in Iron Man 2.
You're listening to Nights on RNZ National. This is Sci-Fi, Sci-Fact. I'm talking to James Rice, trying to explain the facts that might lie behind the fiction of Iron Man, the comic character. Well, not so much him, but his arc reactors. Now, here are a couple of questions for you, James. The first one, why fusion? I mean, there's plenty of fission reactors around. Why didn't he just go for a fission reactor to power himself up?
Well, that's a big problem. Like I said, if you wanted to make something, you know, that you need reasonably close to your chest, you don't want it to be emitting radiation. And that's a really big problem that fission reactors have, is that no matter what, you're generating radiation. That's where the energy comes from, right? And it's more a question of safety in that case. Fusion being sort of the opposite process to a fission reaction, by taking two things and fusing them together, it's not a chain reaction. The products are not then also going to go on into fusion, typically. Whereas with a traditional nuclear fission reactor, sort of uranium or plutonium, those things break down into things that are themselves radioactive. They can then go on and react as well. And in the case of uranium, the neutrons that are released as well cause multiple more reactions. This is the sort of chain reaction that can, in the worst case scenario, cause an explosion, like you might see at, for example, Chernobyl. So in terms of safety, a fusion reactor is really, you know, promising, because you don't have that chain reaction. So there is no physical way it can melt down or explode.
And I
making
guess,
it much safer.
James, there is one thing, however. Here we are on planet Earth. Almost all the energy that powers our life, powers the ecosystem that we live in, everything comes from the sun, from that wonderful fusion reactor just down the road, cosmically speaking, from us. Yet our attempts to actually create fusion or energy from fusion here on Earth, we just haven't cracked it, have we? Isn't it a case of we're putting more energy in than we get out?
Yeah, that's kind of the goal, is that at present, fusion reactors in general still haven't broken that very important milestone, is that we need more power out than we put in. If we want it to generate energy, you need net energy in the first place. And it turns out fusion being so high energy, you have to deal with plasma, and plasma is not exactly the easiest thing to control, and confining that, heating it, and making it stable is still a huge challenge. Even if you've got the biggest and best magnets in the world, it's still not easy to do, and it's enough of a challenge that these reactors tend to be really big. So that's the problem at present, is trying to make it work in a way that's not only going to generate more energy than you put in, but is also economic. So it makes sense to do that from a power generation perspective.
So James, going full circle here, your PhD involves building a high current flux pump to facilitate part of a fusion reaction. So what are you doing that might make this possible?
I guess I'll give you the short pitch on that one. A flux pump is a superconducting power supply. And by using superconductors, you can generate much more current than you could with a sort of the phone charger that you might plug in to charge the battery in your phone, right? They generate much more voltage than I'm aiming to generate, but they do so at a very low amount of current. So those would be sort of like one ampere of current. I'm looking to do sort of 10 kiloamps, 10,000 amps. At that point, the amount of current you're generating is enough to energize a very big superconducting magnet. And I mentioned earlier that most of the reactor designs that people are considering, they're going to use very large electromagnets because they're so big and such high field, magnetic field, you need a lot of current to generate that magnetic field. Doing so means that any sort of resistance in your wire can cause the whole magnet to just melt. In order to avoid that, you use superconductors. And when you have superconductors, you need to power those superconductors as well. So that's really what I'm hoping to do, is use these flux pumps to power the magnetic fields that you use to confine the plasma, and hopefully push the magnetic fields you can use up a bit higher. And for reasons that I'm sure we don't have enough time for right now, what that means is that you generate much more power from your reactor than you would at a lower magnetic field. So what I'm hoping is that these flux pumps giving you more fields from more current allows you to sustain a hotter, denser plasma and generate a lot more power. And hopefully we can push past to power positive and get actual energy out of these reactors.
On paper, is it possible?
It is possible, yeah. And really there are two methods you could use to make it work. We're seeing both of those play out at the moment. You can either make a really big reactor with a lot of plasma that can be kept very hot and reasonably stable for a pretty long period of time. But the size we're talking about is so big that it's multinational. You need many different countries contributing to these sorts of giant fusion reactors to even have a chance of building them. And it takes decades and it's rather slow. The alternative, like I say, is to try and use a stronger magnetic field. And ultimately, that means you can have a much smaller reactor. That means that it can be built much more quickly and hopefully make progress a lot faster than we've seen recently in the last couple of decades.
If it works on paper, why haven't we done it already?
The barrier, like I say, is we're coming up against plasma physics, but we're also coming up against just plain engineering. These things aren't easy to build. They're very large, they're very complicated, and they take a lot of expertise to make. And it's that kind of expertise that I'm hoping one day I'll contribute to.
Is it also a problem that we just haven't found a superconductor that's super enough?
We have now, actually. When the last round of major experiments were being planned, we were kind of not there yet. But we now have these very, very recent, reasonably new high-temperature superconductors that can generate much stronger magnetic fields. There's a couple of extra engineering challenges in making them work, but that's the type of material I work with, and I'm hoping to sort of push that further towards fusion-ready materials.
When you say high temperature, how high?
How high? Not very high. It's still very cold, actually. It's a bit of a misnomer.
Yeah. What, like minus 100
centigrade? I realize now I should say that the first superconductors were liquid helium cooled, so it's very close to absolute zero, sort of 4 degrees Kelvin. But high temperature superconductors take that all the way up to sort of 70 to 90 degrees Kelvin, at which point you can cool them with liquid nitrogen, which is much more readily available and makes things a lot easier as well to work with. Now that those sorts of materials are becoming more commercially available, at the sort of lengths you need to make these really giant magnets that are necessary, we can hopefully make stronger fields, make those reactors a bit more compact and a bit smaller. And maybe one day we'll get enough field into them that we can make them tiny little chest-mounted things, huh?
Just weaning us off fossil fuels would be enough, James.
I'll do my best. No problem, Brian.
James, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you very much, Brian. It's been lovely to talk to you.